Hello and welcome to COVIDcast, a weekly Lowy Institute podcast for anyone interested in understanding the effects of coronavirus on global politics and international life. My name is Ben Bland and I'm the director of the Southeast Asia program at the Lowy Institute here in Sydney, Australia. As this crisis unfolds, we're sitting down every week with Lowy Institute experts to discuss the implications of coronavirus for the world. You'll find all the previous episodes on the homepage of our website. In this episode, I'll be speaking with Hervé Lemahieu about geopolitics and the coronavirus pandemic. Hervé is the director of the Institute's Asian Power and Diplomacy Program and an expert in global politics. Thank you, Hervé, for joining me today.
Thanks for having me.
Hervé, you wrote recently in the Australian Financial Review that it may be the global politics of the pandemic rather than COVID-19 itself that proves our undoing. What exactly did you mean by that?
Well, clearly the coronavirus has caught us off guard, and it's a disease which has burst forth from nature, and in many ways it mocks our human pretenses. It's created not only a public health emergency, but also an economic crisis of global proportions. And in addition to that, I would argue there's also a man-made pandemic of mistrust and chaos, which is testing social cohesion and globalization to its core. So we've seen the West very evidently struggle to come to terms with the scale of the challenge. I would argue the pendulum has swung in Europe and the US from indifference and denialism to pandemonium. And I think we're in a moment of strategic fatalism here, where we increasingly that the West may be in decline as a result of this crisis. But equally, I'd say the Asian century, or the promise of an Asian century, which really was meant to begin in 2020, where we were forecast for the first time since the 19th century, Asian economies would be larger than the rest of the world combined. I would argue this is still the start of the Asian century, just not in the way that many had hoped for. This is an Asian century that's going to be dominated by nation states, by countries turning inwards, by geopolitical competition, international paralysis, and multilateral institutions struggling, gasping for air. So all this is obviously quite negative and really exposes, I think, vulnerabilities within the international system, which were already there but have been exacerbated as a result of this crisis.
So you paint a pretty grim picture there, I think it's fair to say, but you think it's more a case of shining a spotlight on problems that were already there rather than necessarily this pandemic having transformed the world as we know it.
Yes, correct. I think that had this pandemic hit us in the 1990s, we probably would have been in a far better position to deal with it. Why? Because the international system was in far better shape than it is today. We had uncontested unipolarity, US benign hegemony globally. And I think what this coronavirus does is really expose the dangers that lurk within the international system. So the danger is ourselves more than it is the virus. To sound a little bit prophetic here, I think if we're not careful, if we don't calibrate our reactions correctly, then globalization is starting to teeter a little bit like a contemporary Tower of Babel under the weight of its own achievements and interdependence and vulnerabilities.
A Tower of Babel. These are very biblical times, it seems, at least in the way people talk about the crisis. One of the things you mentioned there was the US. And one of the obvious concerns to us all in this crisis has been the very obvious lack of US leadership. It's not exactly a newsflash in the era of President Donald Trump and his many tweets and hangers-on. But the virus has really highlighted just how much we're missing the US at the helm of the world of international crisis response. And there's obviously a stark contrast with the way that President Barack Obama led the coordinated mitigation efforts during the global financial crisis. Now, Singapore Prime Minister Lee Hsien Loong, who's a good friend to Washington in normal times, recently lamented this lack of leadership. But he also argued, I think perhaps rather optimistically, that other configurations will eventually work out in terms of how the world works. And there's been a lot of talk here in Australia too about middle power coalitions emerging to tackle this and other global problems. I mean, do you think PM Lee is right? Can others together fill the very large shoes of the US?
it's a big question. I'm going to be a bit more negative here, and maybe Ben, you have other ideas. But I think that middle power diplomacy, or the crisis, is showing the limits of middle power diplomacy. And I think it's all very well and nice to have a coalition of the willing. We've certainly been talking about that for a long time in the context of the Indo-Pacific, especially. But what this crisis has shown is that when there really is an existential crisis to the internal sovereignty of countries, to their resilience, to their health systems, it's really every country for themselves. I think that's true of the United States in terms of its resource nationalism on display here, and also trying to procure as much critical medical supplies globally as it can for itself, to the extent that European countries have even accused the United States of international piracy. But it's equally true of smaller countries. We're not exempt of this kind of behavior. Every country will be preoccupied in the next several months on domestic priorities, and it will take time to see which constellation of international cooperation, if any, will really materialize. But I suspect it will not be through middle power diplomacy. It will have to be global. Pandemics are quintessentially global affairs, and I think there will have to be some form of return to hard-headed internationalism at the UN, at the G20, that would allow for not only a better spread of critical medical supplies to where they're most needed, but then also to contain the economic fallout globally with sustained debt relief for the developing world. All those initiatives require really things to take place on a global scale, and I think are beyond the remit of middle powers themselves. But Ben, I don't know what you feel about that.
Yeah, I think there's only two things I'd add there. One is that when it comes to US leadership, there really is no other country that brings the same ballast to the table, that brings the same military heft, political heft, economic heft, but also that sense of ambition to be able to tackle these sorts of problems. Just think about how many other middle powers you'd need to cooperate to have the same amount of GDP, the same amount of military capability. And even then you'd be lacking, you know, the coordination and, as I said, that sense of ambition, the can-do spirit. So I think that's one thing that we're really lacking. And I wonder the extent to which that comes back, even if President Donald Trump does lose the election to Joe Biden, if it even happens this year. I mean, the second thing I'd say, that it's obviously, it's not just the US. I mean, all the middle powers and China too have been turning inwards. So recently, and we'll get on to China shortly, we've seen the Chinese government talk about this shared community for mankind, the need for South-South cooperation between China and other developing countries, and the need not to stigmatize developing countries. But China, of course, has followed everyone else in shutting down its borders, banning even foreign residents who are overseas from coming back. So, of course, they're not really doing anything differently in that respect. But I do want to ask about this battle of narratives we've seen between China and the US. Obviously, to some extent, it's a continuation of the deepening tensions between the two great superpowers that we've seen in the last few years. But it really seems to have intensified with US President Donald Trump and his officials trying to paint this as a Chinese problem, a Chinese virus even, China hitting back, some officials spreading these conspiracy theories that the virus originated in US military labs, but also more generally, China sort of reaching out to some developing countries, sending some limited medical teams to Cambodia and the Philippines, sending or selling masks to other countries, and trying to sort of push its narrative out that it's the force that can bring the world together. Who do you think is coming out on top so far in this battle of narratives between the two great superpowers?
I think both superpowers are looking quite defensive and have both failed in critical respects. I think it's important to keep in mind that it's not going to be as clean cut as China running away with the scepter of unipolarity from the Americans. China itself is not strong enough within the international community to save the day. It has nowhere near the monetary power, for example, of the United States. It cannot bail out developing countries in the way that the G20 and the G7 have done previously. And so there are very clear limitations to what it can do here, despite rhetoric to the contrary. The United States, obviously very inward looking, its health crisis at home doesn't do much good for the kind of psychological perception of global US power. So I think both countries, both superpowers here, are looking quite weak, quite defensive, quite desperate. Ultimately, I agree with you, the answers will have to lie in some form of international cooperation, coordination. The world is more multipolar today than at any point since the Cold War, and yet cooperation will have to coexist with strategic competition and a battle for narratives. And it's the countries that can prove not only that they can reduce the fallout of this crisis at home, but are willing to sustain international cooperation abroad that will ultimately prevail in terms of the battle of narratives. It's too soon to call who looks like a winner at this point. Everyone seems to be the loser.
I think there's a lot of truth in that. There's been so much frustration, I think, in the US, in Australia, and in the Western world with the lack of US leadership that we've been seeing in the recent era, that people tend to project their frustrations onto China's capabilities. So while we have seen a few Chinese doctors sent, as I said, to the Philippines and Cambodia and elsewhere, actually their capacity to help is limited, number one. And number two, China, I don't think, has the same desire to fill the US's sort of Shaquille O'Neal size 22 shoes on the global stage. So I don't think we're going to see that. But having spoken about the two superpowers that are, why don't we talk about the third superpower that may yet be or is still sleeping?
Or has been.
Has been, perhaps, Europe and the European Union. So the EU is really the strongest regional body in the world. It's been a great success in many respects, despite the financial crises of the last few years. And I think a lot of people would have expected the EU to deal with this pandemic much better than it has done. But it's really been afflicted by just the same problems of unilateralism that we've seen. Borders go up in Europe just as everywhere else. Unilateral health responses, unilateral financial responses. And just recently, we've seen the EU's chief scientist, Professor Mauro Ferrari, resign, claiming that the pandemic has shone a merciless light on the organization's deficiency. And he lamented the fact that in time of emergencies, people and institutions revert to their deepest nature and reveal their true character. So how damaging a blow to the EU do you think this pandemic has been, Hervé? And I'm hoping we can finally find a point of difference here.
Look, I think it's been hugely damaging. But to come back to one of the founders of the European project, Jean Monnet, he said that Europe will be forged in crises and the European Union will be the sum of the solutions adopted for those crises. So this is definitely one such crisis, and it really rocks the European Union and the very idea of international cooperation between countries, which the EU really represents the most advanced evolution of, to its core. That said, I think as a good European, I will underline a few caveats. And the first is that health systems and healthcare has never been a core competence of the European Union. And as you know, Europe and the European Union is very straitjacketed in terms of its bureaucracy. And I think this is probably the frustration that was felt by the EU's top scientist, now resigned, in the sense that he couldn't get the program he wanted mobilized fast enough and approved by the European Commission in a way that he thought was befitting of the crisis. I think it will take many months, perhaps years, to really see the EU evolve and adapt in the direction of doing more. There are three challenges here. One is that essentially we've got the health crisis affecting the south of Europe, most notably, but actually all of Europe. And Italy is really, you know, actually one of the most advanced healthcare models within the European Union, completely overwhelmed. So it's also spiraling into debt. Then you've got another member state, Hungary, which has essentially become a dictatorship as a result of this crisis, or the crisis was used as a pretext to finally do the deed. And I think you've got a lack of ambition from Germany and others, particularly Angela Merkel in the dying days of her administration. Look, I think the EU can actually get beyond this crisis. Never let a good crisis go to waste. There's already talk of repurposing the European Stability Mechanism or of some sort of EU Marshall Plan, or even corona bonds, so debt mutualization, euro bonds. And I think that this will generate new pressure. And we're already seeing the Dutch, for example, who have been some of the most resolute opponents of this, apologizing for their lack of empathy towards other member states. And we are, as a result of this resignation as well, I think seeing the political pressure ramp up. And as a result of this, we will see the EU probably rise up to this challenge, and we will see a stronger Europe in 5 years. Now, look, that's more of a hope than a prediction, but we've seen it happen before. And this is where the EU is a very different animal to, for example, ASEAN or other regional initiatives. For ASEAN, a crisis like territorial disputes in the South China Sea has really only weakened it. It has not, years after the crisis first started emerging, it has not improved the quality of decision-making coming out of ASEAN. For Europe, the migrant crisis, the debt crisis in 2008, each time we have assumed that this would be the final nail in the coffin. And yet, for some reason, the EU just proves that incrementally it can muddle through. And I do believe that's possible here as well.
Yeah, I think the contrast to ASEAN, the Association of Southeast Asian Nations, is really stark. And ASEAN seems determined to prove that old hackneyed dictum about in every crisis is an opportunity wrong, because they certainly seem determined not to grasp this one at all. ASEAN over the last few years has laid out many plans and frameworks for regional health response, for pandemic response even, and we've seen pretty much zero coordination from the countries of Southeast Asia, which is disturbing on one hand, but on the other, when you look at the capability of the governments in the region, apart from Singapore, and the crises they're facing at home, it's kind of understandable. I want to shift to Australia and what this means for Australia's foreign policy. In the last few years, there's been an intense focus on the new Indo-Pacific strategy, which is really framed around the region you and I would probably call the Asia-Pacific. But this strategy is really a regional one, and we're facing a global crisis. How do you think the COVID crisis should change the way that Canberra sees the world, Hervé?
Yeah, look, I agree. The Indo-Pacific concept has become the primary means by which we understand our fractured region. And it's essentially, if you want to reduce it to something, a form of balance, regional balance of power politics, which I think is an important game to play, but is clearly not the answer to all our problems. In the meantime, Australia has also scaled back its core financial contributions to global multilateral organizations such as the UN and its specialized agencies by about 25% since 2014. And I think an uncontrolled global health crisis and a deep global economic recession presents as much of a challenge to our security, broadly defined, than anything that emerges out of the Indo-Pacific in terms of traditional security challenges. And I also think the answers to that crisis lie in a sort of more global understanding of the problem and in the coordination required to address the issue. I think the other thing, and maybe this is something that I can ask you about, Ben, this is really a challenge above all of internal sovereignty and resilience. So state weakness here is going to be crucial to the way in which countries can either prove to withstand this virus or succumb to it. And I think what this really does is undermine our faith in a lot of other middle powers, particularly in Southeast Asia, Indonesia, but also even larger ones, major powers like India, whose governance may really not be up to scratch yet. And, you know, as much as the conversation's been focused about the West, at the end of the day, some of the oldest, richest, and most capable states in the international system are in the West. And what this really does to me is raise a big question mark about the capability and the state weakness, the underlying state weakness within emerging Asia, and how that could actually impact the balance, the regional balance of power. And I think Australia may have to actually revise some of its assumptions and perhaps play less of the geopolitical game, or in order to play the geopolitical game, we'll have to refocus on internal institutions, quality of governance, conventional aid programs in the partners that it really wants to invest in.
I think the internal sovereignty point is fascinating, because for a lot of developed countries, this is simply a question of how they fine-tune their public health policies and their economic policy. And there might be some shifts there, but it's unlikely to be transformative. Australia is unlikely to wake up in a year's time as a socialist country, for example. But I think for the likes of Indonesia, it's a very different sort of challenge. We've seen Indonesia in its response put generals and police officers in the front line of the response. They're fighting an information war. There's a kind of hearts and minds battle between the central government and local governments over who's controlling the narrative. So this looks much more like a kind of counterinsurgency strategy. And that kind of reflects the, I think, fragilities of a state like Indonesia, in the sense that the government feels, as you say, it's fighting an internal sovereignty, an internal battle. And that has a lot of implications for its ability to really step up in the world in the way that a lot of people in Australia and elsewhere in the Western world would like to see a country like Indonesia, or perhaps it's similar for India, do. So I think this is going to change kind of the framing. But the last thing I want to ask about is really the balance of power, because we've talked a lot today and there've been many, many columns written about how the world's going to be transformed by COVID. And I can see how that's the case in terms of public health, particularly in the countries or the global organizations where their systems and responses have been been found wanting. I can also see how this might contribute to intensifying that trend of some reshoring of manufacturing, particularly for key pharmaceutical and medical equipment. And it's still early days yet, but I wonder if this will really transform geopolitics as much as people think. We often, especially in our industry, tend to exaggerate some of the changes we think, and things tend to carry on much more as normal than we would imagine. And you analyze power for a living, Hervé. You run the Asia Power Index. Do you think, you know, in a year's time or 18 months as the pandemic passes, will this crisis ultimately have dramatically affected the balance of power in the world? Or will we be looking at a very similar world 18 months from now in terms of geopolitics?
Look, I'm going to apply my very cold-hearted sort of analysis of power here. And what I do is I look at the fundamentals. So, for example, Italy, one of the hardest hit countries in the world by the coronavirus, we've seen 17,000 deaths. This is a statistic, but every one of those deaths is a tragedy. But 17,000 deaths, even if we triple that to 50,000 deaths, which hopefully will never happen, but that still only represents about 0.08% of a population of 60 million people. So how will this really affect Italy? Will Italy suddenly become Venezuela? I don't think so. Fundamentally, Italy will still be Italy, perhaps slightly smaller. And in fact, the governments that have the resources to fight this pandemic on two fronts, not only the health emergency, but also to contain the economic fallout through generous welfare social nets, will be those that will recover the fastest. So I actually think that, yes, we're all going to be exposed to a global recession. But insofar as this afflicts the globe, it doesn't actually change the relativities all that much. This is a virus that's playing out at different times, but it's the same movie in different countries. We're all on that sort of curve. There is a sometimes it's a bit steeper, but ultimately it does start leveling off. And even though we're now at the height in the West, I think, of the health epidemic, we probably have a little bit more certainty in terms of how this thing will eventually end. We don't know when, but we know how. And that is that globalization will be frozen for the time being, but countries can keep themselves alive on life support, provided they have the economic means to do so. I'm a little bit more worried about developing Asia, as I've already mentioned, and I think that may actually have an impact on the balance of power within Asia. Finally, I think that we're going to have to reassess the way in which we think of an Asian century. There's no doubt that we are moving into an Asian century. It's just going to be far less benign than we think it is. Geopolitics, the nation state, will be far more important. But again, you could argue this crisis has simply exposed those underlying realities. It's not actually changed them fundamentally. So that's where I'll end it.
Well, thanks again, Hervé, for joining me for today's discussion on geopolitics and the novel coronavirus. COVIDcast is a limited edition weekly podcast from the Lowy Institute. Thank you to my colleague, Madeline Neist, for production assistance. Please keep an eye on our social media channels for details of the next episode of COVIDcast. And you can stay up to date with all the latest developments on coronavirus via the Lowy Institute's widely read digital magazine, The Interpreter. Thank you all for listening today, and we'll catch up with you again next week.